is versus the what's your new title? I don't even know what your new title is.
Researcher. Senior research officer is the technical term
for it. Senior research officer at the NRC. Just come back from a tour going around the world talking to people about cutting edge e-learning stuff. And is here to talk about a paper that had just gone out and is for which conference do you have?
It's for IT Forum, the IT Forum discussion list. And what IT Forum is just an online mailing list that is inhabited by predominantly instructional technology theorists. So they're heavy on the theory side of things, and pedagogical theory, and Vygotsky and Moore and all that kind of stuff. And so this was for that group. And the way IT Forum works is once a month they take 1 week out of their schedule and they devote that week to talking about a specific paper. And this is paper number 92. They've been doing it for a while, and this week is mine. So, which is kind of neat, and it's a special sort of feeling, you know, when the moderator comes on and says, "Okay, everyone, we'll be talking about Stephen Downes' paper." It's kind of like you feel sort of special. I'm going to sit down for this if that's all right, because. No, there's not a huge group of us here. There may be more people coming online. We are recording. We're recording 8 ways over Sunday, really. You never did do the...
No.
Okay.
We'll just put up the audio slideshow. I think it's just easy.
Sure. But I'm recording on Audacity there, as you can see. I'm also recording on this thing in case that fails, which it does from time to time. And then we're also Skype casting this... session, and there's the Skype cast page, and there's the Skype cast itself, and right now we are not joined to the Skype cast. Do you think maybe we should join the Skype cast?
It was joined a while ago.
Yeah,
while
that is. To the
it's been acting a little bit weird recently.
So,
that is, and this is saying that
it is saying it's on. Maybe it's lying.
Yeah, I think it is lying. It's been doing that recently.
Okay. So we think we're Skype casting, but we're not positive. So there is a small group of you. I'm not sure. First of all, how many of you know about me and what I do at all? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so a few of you. Okay. Like more than that. because it's such a small group, if I can just get an idea of who you are and what you do before I start, that would give me more information to work with. So I'll start there because he's trying to hide.
Well, my name is Dave Cornet, and I'm the tech coordinator at the CIPC, and work here in the university and teach a little bit of using stuff online.
Psychologist and the linguist I'm most afraid of here. okay. That's interesting. This is a pretty theoretical talk. And if you don't want me to go the way that these slides indicate that I'm going, tell me. And I'll go in a different direction. That's not to say I'm going to recant my theories or anything like that. But if you're finding the direction of the talk to be boring or uninteresting to you, and you'd really rather be talking, oh, I don't know, learning management systems, whatever, I can do that. But I do have this talk prepared, and the reason for that is because of the coincidence with the IT Forum talk. And I think it was useful to me. I'm hoping it'll be useful to you as well. We'll see. So, and again, there's such a small group. I was saying earlier, the more people there are, the more I get to talk. It's a small group, which means you get to talk lots if you want. If you do talk, please talk loudly so we get you on record. That way we'll have evidence for later. And we will use it. just because there will be, I'm sure there will be people who are listening to this later on, and it'd be nice if they were able to make out all the voices.
Just to follow up on that, this will end up being a podcast, and there are thousands and thousands of people who visit Stephen's blog every day for guidance in terms of instructional technology, theoretical theories of education, stuff like that. So this will end up being a podcast there.
There won't be thousands and thousands of people listening to the audio.
No, but maybe.
But there will be more. Anyhow, sounds good so far? Okay. Actually, I didn't even do an outline slide. Oh, well. There we go. That treescape is from Kruger National Park in South Africa. A lot of the stuff that I'm saying now has emerged from that trip that I did, and I sort of expected it, and I sort of didn't expect it. I didn't expect the sorts of things to come out of it that actually did come out of it. What this presentation does overall is, at first, describes what may be called a traditional theory of learning, and then offers an alternative connectivist or emergentist theory of learning. And what this theory of learning does is provides a theoretical and semantical context for the tools that we're using to provide online learning, and especially for the tools that are being used in what we're calling e-learning 2.0 or Web 2.0. And the idea here is to show that we're not just picking tools out of the air because they're popular and saying, oh, try this, but there is actually a method to the madness. There is a basis in theory for the application of these tools in this way, and there is a pedagogy that emerges out of that. And that's what this talk does, is it describes this pedagogy. But it's I hate to introduce my talks by saying, well, it's a hard talk. But it is a hard talk because what we're used to in terms of what we know, how we think, how we come to believe things, we are very much rooted in what might be called a traditional theory. I'm going to represent it in this talk as a cognitivist theory. And it is very difficult, almost impossible, for us to pull ourselves out of that. And you'll even see as I go through this, if you analyze the way I express things, the way I say things, a lot of my manners of expression are rooted more in the old theory than in the new theory. That's job hazard. So, well, there's a real lag when I click and then it thinks, and then I don't know whether that's
just being dramatic.
It is. Okay, cognitivism. This. One of the first criticisms I saw that came out was, cognitivism is more complex than I presented. Well, obviously, it's going to be more complex than I'm presenting in one slide here or in one page in the paper. But roughly, very, very roughly, like seat of the pants roughly, cognitivism is the idea that there are things in our head that we call beliefs or knowledge or wishes, desires, hopes, those sorts of mental entities. And that those mental entities actually stand for things. So we have what we might say are our representations or models in our head. And those representations or models actually correspond to things that are out there in the real world. So if I have a picture of a table in my head, you might say, then that corresponds to a table. Or if I have the word table in my head, that corresponds to a table. One example of this, and it's only an example, although I'll say that what I say holds for the rest of them, is what might be called the brain writing theory. And this is This is sort of along the lines of promoted by Chomsky or Jerry Fodor or others, volitionists and others. The idea that we have sentences in the brain. Now, of course, we don't have real sentences, you know, made out of type. And that, but there are neural configurations of some sort, I'm washing that a bit there, that correspond to sentences. And there are physical instances of sentences, in some sense, in the brain, and that these sentences have semantical import. That is to say, these sentences actually refer to or correspond to or represent states of affairs in the world. And people really believe this. And if you think about it, you really believe this. If I ask you, what do you believe, you give me a sentence of some sort. And so, you know, and you know, if you were asked to map out your thoughts, you know, you might draw a picture, but probably you'll start writing stuff. If I ask you how you're thinking, a lot of you will say, well, I'm thinking I hear a voice in my head, and I think that way. Not everybody, obviously, but a lot of people do think that way. So it is a very plausible theory in the sense that it does correspond with the impression many of us have of how thinking happens. So what this means then is that there is something concrete, which is a thing that we can put our finger on, that's in our head, that corresponds to the rest of the world. So the traditional theory is the folk psychological theory, not in this paper, but in another one I write, I describe it as the naive causal theory, which is, I guess, kind of a put down, isn't it? I have Skype on. Except I think that's somebody saying hi to you. So we may have people on the Skype cast now. If you are on the Skype cast, we don't have speakers set up here, so even if you talk, we won't hear you. And actually, let's just see if I'm actually talking to real people or if there's nobody there. Okay. That is a real bad time to get a Skype message, isn't it? All right, there still is nobody.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. All right, good enough. We'll come back to this. Where this traditional theory overlaps with learning, especially distance learning, is in the area of communication theory. This is where the two approaches intersect. Now, again, I'm really lost in communication theory. You can go on the web, right? There's a page, right? There's like 20 different communication theories. But they're all roughly, loosely, with caveats, based on the premise that there is something like the channel of communication. And stuff goes across this channel. So that you have a sender and a receiver. And the sender is sending something, and then the receiver is receiving something. And then the rest of the terminology and the metrics and you know, the overall frame that you're dealing with is describing how this channel works, how to improve this channel, properties of the channel, signal versus noise and all of that. But the idea is that you've got something in one person's head. One way or another, you're going to move it down this channel and put it into some other person's head. And again, I know that that's a gloss, but it's the sort of gloss that you give when you have 30 seconds to talk about a theory and start 3 years. So, the theory, as I say, is based on the integrity of the communications. You want to make sure that proposition P that's in person A's head ends up being the same as proposition P that's in person B's head. And everything else has to do with how you make sure, how you verify. And this is, to me, the major advance that Moore brought to distance learning. Is I'm not sure if he knew about this or if he simply emulated it, but basically what he brings to distance education theory is the concept of the checksum, which is to say an interaction or a dialogue to make sure that the transfer from person A to person B has occurred correctly. And that's in computer science, that's what a checksum is.
You send the signal, the receiving computer sends back the signal to the originating computer to prove that the signal did arrive and arrive correctly. And so that's, you know, and in the traditional theory, that's the idea of interaction. The idea of interaction is, to a large degree, to make sure that you got the signal correctly. Now, I know that, again, there are many areas of educational theory which go beyond that. For example, after receiving the signals, there may be a process of some sort that happens in the receiver's mind. And so we get something like constructivism, where you don't just get, you know, pee, lock, stock, and barrel into the other person, but you get some signals that prompt the construction of pee. But you're still trying to go from pee to pee. You're still trying to get the same thing in the learner's head as was in the instructor's head. And everything else has to do with the mechanics of how you're going to do that. And I use that phrase very deliberately because, really, when you think about this, these sorts of theories are theories that apply physical properties to the transfer of knowledge from one person to another. They're theories that have us imagine, if you will, perhaps by metaphor or analogy, that these are like physical things. And so the beliefs are like physical objects, and the channel of communication is like a channel or a pipe or something like that. And you know, even think constructivism, how it brings that physical metaphor, and you're going to build something up. And you have this picture, these models, almost as though they're like, you know, Legos or a record set or something like that in your head. So there's very much this cause and effect, you do this will be the result kind of model going on there. And it's this cause and effect kind of model that I'm after. And this isomorphism model as well. Because the idea all along here is that what's going on in your head parallels what's going on out there in the world. And actually, it's a three-way isomorphism here. You're going to play with these brain writing theories. What goes on in your head is isomorphic with the linguistic representation of what's going on in your head, which is in turn isomorphic with what's going on in the world. And that's how you ground these things. You ground these things because you say, oh yeah, there is that relation, there is that cause, one to the other, therefore, if you have a physical instantiation, you have a mental instantiation. If you have a mental instantiation, you'll have a corresponding physical instantiation. So far, so good? Are you okay with that description? I know it's a bit of a wash, but okay. The core of the alternative theory is that isomorphism doesn't exist. That there is not, in fact, a direct correlation between entities in our head and entities in the world. That there is a divide there. And the nature of this divide is essentially what we call, say, the belief that P, the idea that P, the knowledge that P, is actually a pattern of connectivity, a pattern of neural connectivity. But the thing is, this pattern of neural connectivity isn't a particular pattern of neural connectivity. There's no relation between the event that caused the connectivity and the connectivity itself. I show you all this. I'm showing, for those of you who are listening to this, I'm showing the iRiver, and you each get a pattern of connectivity in your head, but that pattern of connectivity is not the same. It's going to be different for every one of you, and if I show it to you now, it'll be different than it was just a few seconds ago. There's no thing inside your head that is actually going to correspond to the perception of this iRiver. So what I'm doing is separating, in an important way, the mental contents from the physical thing that they're supposed to represent. Now, that doesn't mean I've created some sort of hand of God theory of the mind, right? I'm still saying that there's a causal relationship there. But what I'm saying is that the causal relationship is one such that you cannot directly tie the two things together. I'll give you an example of what I mean. And this is from a more recent paper, actually. Now think about a bolt of lightning. Right? Now imagine I went out, walked in a field, and got struck by a bolt of lightning. And then we ask, well, what caused that? Right? And the answer, the only effective answer, is nothing. Because it's true that there is a causal story that can be told about a bolt of lightning, but there's no effective causal story that can be told. There's nothing out there in the world that corresponds to the cause of that bolt of lightning. Oh, sure, I mean, we talk about warm air masses and cold air masses and pressure systems and thunder clouds and electronic balances. We can even talk about how stupid I was, you know, walking out in the field, right? But certainly my walking out in the field didn't cause that. Certainly that storm cloud didn't cause that, because it could have caused it 30 seconds later or 30 seconds earlier or 30 feet over there. So although there is a causal story behind the lightning bolt, there is no cause. And the important thing to recognize here is that what we're calling the cause, when we're talking about what causes mental phenomena or physical phenomena or lightning bolts, is an interpretation that we are bringing to the event. We've got something that is very complicated, and we look at this thing that's very complicated, and we try to see patterns. We try to recognize shapes. So that's an interpretation we bring to it, and that is the cause of the lightning bolt. Well, that's messy. This isn't just me making this up. I know it's tempting to think that it is, and you know, there are days I wish it was just me making it up. But there's been a lot of work done in a number of different areas that does form a theoretical basis for what I've just described. In philosophy, the concept is called supervenience. And the idea of supervenience is that you have a phenomenon that is not dependent on or caused by another phenomenon, but there is no change in the other phenomenon without a corresponding change in the current phenomenon. In other words, they always move in sync, but they're not caused. And Paul Churchman describes that quite a bit as well, out of Donald Davidson. In the area of computer science, and those of you who are from computer science, you'll be familiar with neural networks and connections, the work of Ramahart and McLaughlin, and even Minsky and Papert. That is Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert. Seymour Papert, you may recognize these days as being behind the main laptop initiative and working with them. And again, in connectionism, in computer science, you don't create a program out of instructions and flow charts and databases and things like that. You basically create a model which is structured very similar to a neural network. It's the original basis for this was the neural network and the brain model. The computer models are very different from the real brain. And then you get the model to do things. You train the model to recognize patterns. And then it's this process of pattern recognition that gives the neural network some sort of computational pattern. An example of where this would be used is that I've seen, so my roots are in Alberta, in testing oil pipes for failures. And there's, again, you know, the failure of an oil pipe, right? There's no cause of that. But if you can train a neural network to have sensors all the way down the pipe, and then changes in the flow to be recognized as an impending failure. So it can recognize, after it has been trained, it can recognize an impending failure of the pipe. Not from any particular indication, but just this pattern is like the other pattern in some not necessarily knowable way. And then third, and this has been a big thing recently in social networks, social network theory. Duncan J. Watts with his book Six Degrees, and a lot of the work that's been done online in the area of, I keep saying the word social networks, I don't want to just keep repeating it. I'm trying to think of another way to say it, but the idea of the connectedness of individuals and the way ideas move from person to person through networks of connections between individual people online. And this work has been extended to other kinds of networks as well. I remember one network in particular, the chirping of crickets, and the question was, why do crickets all chirp in rhythm? The because normally critics don't do analysis. And the analysis that came out of it was that crickets can hear other crickets. So like any given cricket won't hear all of the other crickets, but they hear a few other crickets nearby. And so once one cricket starts chirping, another one starts chirping, and they tend to move in sync. And then this tendency to move in sync spreads through a network. So you get an entire chorus of crickets all chirping in rhythm. One of the essential principles of this is the concept of distributed representation. And this is the story that explains how it can be that we can have a thought about Paris without there being a thought in our head that corresponds to the city of Paris or any other instance of Paris. And that is the concept of distributed representation. And the idea here is that a concept, any concept, is not equivalent to, say, some single neuron firing or even some set of neuron firing, but rather a certain pattern of connectivity between large numbers of neurons. And I say a certain pattern, I don't mean that it should happen to actually accidentally hit that pattern, you know, like in Paris out of nowhere, but rather when we think of Paris, this typically corresponds to something like a pattern of connectivity. So, I wish I had a board I could draw on. Pretend I'm drawing on the board here. So, instead of the belief that, or a thought about Paris being here, you have a thought about Paris that's all over the place. So, it actually corresponds to this whole bunch of things happening across your brain. And so, you don't say that there's a particular thing. This is where you split off between the physical analogy. There's not a particular thing in our head that is, you know, Paris is the capital of France. There's no sentence like that. That's the complex of neural activations. What makes this tricky is that the sentence Paris is the capital of France shares the same set of neurons with other sentences. Frogs are green, Dave is in the room, all of these other sentences actually share the same set of neurons. So it's not even like there's one pattern for Paris, another pattern for Dave, another pattern for frogs. They overlap, which means that your belief that Paris is the capital of France is actually situated, embedded in this mesh of other beliefs. And this mesh of this embeddedness is not necessarily always a logical or a rational connection. It might just be they just happen to be sharing the same neuron because that's the way stuff went into the brain. So the actual physical instance of a thought that Paris is the capital of France in your mind will be very different from someone else's. Not different simply in the sense that it's constructed differently, but different in the sense that it is going to be associated both randomly and non-randomly with other bits of knowledge in your mind. When I say Paris is the capital of France, now, for the rest of your lives, this is true. Check this in your ear. For the rest of your lives, every time you think of Paris, you're going to think, frogs are green. That was maybe not a good example. That was completely subconscious. I did not mean to do that. So just think dream. See, this is why I don't like recording these things. It was totally subconscious. Wow. Okay, let's do something else. Because it'll still work. This is what kills me. It'll still work. Every time you think of Paris, you will think,
Project Green is locked in there now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Earlier, frogs are fine
now.
Yeah. We just understand that there were no intentions otherwise than to make an example. But you know what I mean, right? And actually, I'm living, watching, talking of an unintentional example of the phenomenon I'm trying to describe. I just hope I don't get too much trouble for this recording.
We can always just chop it out and see if that's no problem.
Yeah, I know, but I like to be honest about things. things, and that's the way it came out, softly. So you see what I mean, though, right? One thought is embedded with another. One thought is actually part of another. Now, if you think about it, in the old theory, this can't be the case, right? Sentences have discrete existence. Now, sentences do have words in common, like the word Paris, say, but the word in common has the same meaning throughout. The city of Paris refers to the city of France. If you use it in one sentence, and if you use it in another sentence, it refers to the same city, but it's not a different city, it's not somehow different. If I said Paris is the capital of France, and then I later say, I'm going to Paris in the spring, I mean the same thing by both instances of the word Paris. But that doesn't happen if the word Paris is embedded and enmeshed in a whole bunch of other concepts like that. If it is enmeshed, then every use, every utterance of Paris is going to have a different meaning. There is not going to be a correspondence between the thought that Paris and that city. There might be a loose overlap that we recognize as being some sort of relation, but there is not, in fact, a correlation one to the other. We have to see the correlation. There isn't one for us to measure or find. That's what I get at with this whole pattern recognition thing. We've all seen that picture of the face of Jesus on Mars. How many of you think the face of Jesus really is on Mars? Dave?
Yeah.
Right. And so we have one person who thinks God is part of Mars or like Jesus, and the rest of us think, well, what? Right. Obviously, the interpretation is something that we are bringing to this particular phenomenon, right? If we did not have Christianity in our society, if there was no Jesus, if we were in an alternative world, we would not be saying, hey, that's the face of Jesus. We'd be saying something like, hey, that's the face of George Harrison, or whatever. The recognition is not simply the phenomenon being presented to us, but also our interpretation of that phenomenon. Now, this is significant when we start talking about emergentist phenomena, because what happens when you have a representation that is distributed across a number of entities is that it is presented to you not as that thing in itself, but rather as a pattern. Much like the pattern that if you look at Richard Nixon on the television set, right? You're not being presented with Richard Nixon himself, but you're being presented with a whole bunch of pixels, a pattern on a TV screen. And then it's up to you to look at that TV screen and say to yourself, oh yeah, that's Richard Nixon. And sometimes this example falls flat when I'm doing it with groups with younger people, and younger people like Richard who? And then, you know, they would not recognize Richard Nixon. Which, of course, illustrates the point exactly. We bring the interpretation that this is Richard Nixon. This is why it's uncaused. If it were caused, then we could say, reliably, this presentation of patterns will give us the thought Richard Nixon. But that doesn't happen unless we recognize it. So we have to bring something to the event. So it isn't a cause or a thing. And similarly, when a lightning bolt strikes out of the sky, we recognize it as a lightning bolt. We see this as distinct from the larger entity that is the thunderstorm, or the thunder. The distinction between thunder and lightning is a perceptual distinction, but not necessarily an ontological distinction. How are we going so far? Some thumbs? I hope you're finding it. Probably not. Yeah. Okay. Now we're getting to some of the payoff for this. And again, I could go on about what I've gone on about so far for the next 2 weeks, but here's the payoff. And the payoff is this. First of all, knowledge is sub-symbolic. It is not the same as sentences. It's not even the same as pictures. It exists in the
sense that it exists at all at a level lower than physical representations of it. Knowledge, and when I say knowledge, I can mean also beliefs, hopes, desires, any of these mental phenomena. Knowledge is distributed. The belief Paris is the capital of France isn't located in a particular spot in your brain. It's located through a network of connections across your brain. But this is true. How do I want to say this? I want to say these implications are true both for knowledge inside the head and knowledge outside the head. That's an area I've glossed a little bit. I actually gloss in the paper a little bit. I draw it up in more detail in another paper. But even the knowledge Paris is the capital of France, when we think of that as a public thing, the public knowledge that Paris is the capital of France, that too is distributed. And the reason why I say this is the simple and obvious reason. There's no entity in the world, none, that corresponds to or is the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. Right? We know this as a society only insofar as individual people in our society believe this to be true. So, as a bit of public knowledge, it is also distributed. But even when you analyze it, when you look at, say, the word capital, and what the word capital means, there's no single meaning of the word capital, but rather what counts is the meaning of the word capital is also distributed through society. We could not go out there, even looking at dictionaries and encyclopedias, we could not go out there and find a definitive thing that is the word capital. In fact, you look kind of silly doing it. He's walking around, I'm looking for the meaning of the word capital somewhere. It's just not there. Right? It's actually physically distributed. The meaning of the word capital does not exist. It's all over the place. Knowledge is interconnected. The meanings of one thing affect the meanings of other things. What you believe about Paris impacts what you believe about capitals, impacts what you believe about France, impacts what you believe about this other thing. This interconnectedness is not necessarily logical or reasonable or rational. It's a network property. It's just the fact of the connectedness of the entities in the network containing this knowledge. Knowledge is personal. And if you think about it, it has to be that way. Your knowledge that Paris is the capital of France is different from my knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. And it's different because what Paris is the capital of France, what that sentence means to you, is different from what it means to me. Now, we can come up with theories about saying, oh, maybe there's an overlap, we must be in the same sort of city, all of that. But we're not going to ground that in truth or truth conditions, because even if we try to get at what makes Paris as the capital of France true, we're not going to be able to find some entity out there in the world that corresponds to some entity in our mind. It's just not there. So it'd be like trying to match things that don't exist. Knowledge is emergence. The knowledge that Paris is the capital of France, that itself is a recognition, something we impose on something that we're looking at. If Dave says to me, knowledge, or say Paris is the capital of France.
Paris is the capital of France.
Okay, see, I don't believe he knows that. Not with that tone. But you see, what happens is Dave says something, and now I, as a receiver, interpret it. I've got a whole bunch of signals coming in, a whole bunch of neurons coming in, this horrible mess of perceptions. There's no thing coming at me through a channel, Paris is the capital of France. Right? That's not happening. Right? I'm getting a mess of perceptions that I am interpreting as Dave knows it. Paris is the capital of France. And if I trust Dave, another interpretation, I might actually come to believe that Paris is the capital of France. But I wouldn't. So, in the communication, I'm bringing as much to the communication as Dave is. And if I'm bringing as much to the communication as Dave is, then whatever Dave sent me didn't include all of that that I'm bringing to it. So, what Dave had in his head is very different from what I had in my head, even though we come out with something like this.
because we have a system of agreements where we've decided that we will agree that perhaps the seat of government is a capital, that the principal city population might be a capital but isn't all. There are certain things that you come to an agreement to, and therefore that.
Well, the agreement presupposes the conclusion it's trying to draw. The agreement presupposes that some sort of communication is taking place, namely the agreement. And so you can't use that as the basis of communication. So I understand what you're saying, and it feels like an agreement. But
you're saying theoretically that it can't be proven that it is, or it can't, but it does convey something that we all have an agreement on. Everybody in this room knows what we mean by that. We come to that point where we've got a consensus on.
I don't agree with that. I think that you're assuming that.
I am assuming that. That's
right. And now, in your assumption of that, that is the interpretation of the world that you are bringing to the table. You are bringing to the table, everyone else means the same thing.
But that's the whole science of language, is that we decide on a certain word in a certain context as meaning a certain part.
What I'm saying is it doesn't work that
way. Okay.
I
just don't see the amount of dissonance happening in people's heads here. When you're talking about the Paris being the capital of France that would be elicited through this, what you're saying, I think we've all got this agreement.
Why should I expect dissonance? Nothing in my theory says there should be dissonance.
But there is. You're saying that there's no agreement, basically. You're saying there is no absolute. We know there's no absolute. But the only thing we can depend on is an agreement, since there is no absolute.
No, the only thing each one of us depends on is our own interpretation of the perceptions that we're receiving. And as long as we're comfortable with that interpretation, there's no dissonance. But there's nothing to say that my interpretation is the same or different as yours.
Okay, but if we get together, we can decide whether there is some commonality. If we say, oh, do you think it has an Eiffel Tower? Yep, I do. What about the other here? Yep, we think that.
Well, we can decide that.
That's what we can decide and agree within our context. That's what we agree, and that's why we can look it up in a dictionary, because within our context, we've agreed that that's what it means, right?
So what you're saying that communication occurs through this magical process of communication?
No, it occurs through a system of agreement.
But you can't have agreement without communication.
Right.
And so if you're basing communication on agreement, and you're basing agreement on communication, you've just drawn a big circle. You're supporting your conclusion with your premises.
Okay, so what's the point of this whole thing that is not? What will this mean for us? That there is no. I mean, to say it's not an absolute, we know that. To know that it's an abstraction rather than something concrete, we know that. But where does it lead us? What is the problem, or what will result in having agreed that? You know, it's just chaos, and there is no, and we're all in our little world, and we can't.
Well, I mean, I think it's a bit of a misrepresentation to say that the world is either the way you say it is, or chaos. I mean, that's not a really fair thing to say. I'm trying to represent it as there is an intermediate position between absolute, or even agreement on meaning, and chaos, and that is that we bring a pattern recognition to our own understanding of the world.
Our own understanding, which has been passed along from other people.
What has been passed along is just a mess of signals. That's the whole point. The meaning isn't passed along because it's something different in the other person's head. It's completely and literally something different. And what you're doing is you're saying, oh, but it's really the same. How is it the same? Oh, we agree it's the same. Well, how do you agree it's the same? Well, it's because it's the same. Right?
Okay.
It's not the same.
It's more the same than when I have a picture in my head of Moscow, my picture in my head is more the thing with your parrot as than my motto, right? There is some similarity.
In
terms of agreement.
You're saying now you have a picture in your head that corresponds with the physical thing that is the city of Moscow.
No, the concept of Moscow, not the city of Moscow. The concept.
Where did the concept come from?
Words.
The concept came from words. So you have a concept in words that give you a picture. How did you do that?
Don't know.
See, there's where the magic happens.
Okay, tell me where.
No, that's just it. That's the magic part from your
theory. Okay, but unfortunately, some of us have, there's that game, what's that game called, to draw?
Pictionary.
Now, I cannot do that game because I can't draw, and my representation would be, but there are people that would agree, oh, his is better than hers, and that must mean there is some kind of picture in a universal one, or more or less universal.
Because people say something is better than the other, that it follows then that there's some universal ideal picture?
Well, there's some commonality, that's what I'm
saying. See,
you don't have the Eiffel Tower in your mind, is there?
Might I suggest
that
we just sort of...
Okay.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. I think that there's... I would say that the Eiffel Tower in your head is probably different than the picture. The one that pops up in my head immediately is one of those little things that goes on top of the shelf.
Yeah, okay, that's mine too. Yeah.
It's not the Eiffel Tower.
I think it's the large, steel, full-size Eiffel Tower. So.
Can you see the whole thing in one picture? I can't do that either. How about the rivets?
You have the rivets?
All of them?
Not quite all.
Okay.
Okay.
As soon as we push the picture of it, it falls apart. And okay. This is just it. As long as like you gloss it over and say, oh yeah, communication happens, we agree. No problem.
Okay.
As soon as you push the picture, it falls apart.
Okay.
Right. There is still, because of culture, shared understanding of the concept that is attempting to be communicated. If I go look for a beer with a guy from now, his idea of what's going to happen when we're sitting at the table, going to have a beer, it's going to be way different than what I think is going to happen when we're sitting at the table up here. But we go for a guy because we're humans, that we're going to sit at a table and have a beer. So there are certain similarities in any communication, and the closer you get to the same culture, the more that understanding is similar.
Oh.
I'm saying I'm colorblind. There's another good example. Okay? My picture of red is way different than your picture of red in my head because I don't see red and green.
I'm not going to argue about it, and I just want to give you sort of a reverse example. At Lourdes, Bernadette at Lourdes, she was this little ignorant. Has been growing in France, and she's all Virgin Mary. And when she was questioned by the clergy, who didn't believe her either, he said, "How do you know it's Virgin Mary?" She said, "Because she looks just like her statue."
Yeah.
And that, I think, is closer to what you're getting at. This is the idea not that at all. It's that the pattern of emission.
Right.
And that is the thing is that's why the kids don't recognize it because they have to be accepted.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Right. So I just thought you'd enjoy that again.
No, I like that.
Yeah. And by the way, that's why they accept the number of visions.
I'm going to have to keep writing the teacher, real cheese,
and it's like this, like, great for you.
Excuse me, quick question. When you're talking about knowledge, are you talking about the physical structures within the brain that are allowing us to store that information, or are you talking about the conscious manifestation of that? So when we're talking about Paris as the capital of France, are we talking about whatever up here, whatever brain matter, is keeping that, or are we talking about
as human being have this bit of information or all of it.
That's kind of the fun bit when you ask that, because like Paris is the capital of France, and I think of what that is in my head, that's an echo of a perception that I had previously. Someone has uttered the word Paris is the capital of France, and I'm having that echo phenomenon in my head. But that's not knowledge. That's an echo of some physical phenomenon. What I would call a belief, and this is loose, very loose, is a pattern of connectivity in the brain. What I call knowledge is a belief that you can't not have. In other words, because there's plasticity in our connectivity. Our connectivity itself can change, and what we recognize in those patterns can change. There's a famous example from Russell Hens, the duck rabbit system. You may have seen that, right? The picture that looks like a duck or it looks like a rabbit is the same picture. You can see it either way. There's all kinds of examples like that. Same perception, exactly the same perception, but depending on how we interpret it, it could be one, it could be the other. And beliefs in general are like that. Beliefs in general are this recognition. Ooh, that's a duck. Ooh, that's a rabbit. Ooh, that's a city of Paris. Right? And you're recognizing something as something. Some things we can only recognize one way. There isn't an alternative. There's no rabbit to worry about. That's knowledge. It's when we can only recognize things one way. It's a belief that we can't not have.
And that is your particular definition.
Oh, that's mine. That's completely mine.
That would be generally accepted by Renaissance people. So that is
the
coming in.
In fact, that particular articulation of it is maybe 10 days old. So there hasn't even been time for people to accept it or not accept it. But I think, you know, the story about beliefs being patterns of connectivity isn't necessarily mine alone. I'm pretty sure that it pushed some other people into the West St. Paul Church, for example, or where they were all hurt. It pushed would say that. I don't see that as being a particularly radical position to have. And so the beliefs as a perception here, as knowledge as a belief you can't not have, it seems to me to be a logical outgrowth of that.
Can you have knowledge without having words?
Of course. When you look at cats, cats know things. Cats know lots of things. Cats, my cats know when I'm coming home. I know that because they're overnight cats all over me, right? But cats don't have words. Therefore,
I don't know they don't have words. Maybe we just turn on the TV. No, they don't have words. They don't have words. Cats don't have words.
I think it's a pretty fair proposition to say that cats don't have language. My theory hinges on that. I don't think it hinges on that, right? I do think that. But cats certainly can have belief states. I had one cat drinks water out of the sink. Right? She jumps up onto the sink, and I turn the tap on a little bit, and it drips, and she drinks. She just loves to do that. She does that at the bathroom, which means every time she thinks somebody's going to the bathroom, down the door. And, well, she doesn't always get it right. And sometimes I'm just going in that general direction, but she'll anticipate. So cats have beliefs. And some of the beliefs that cats have can be wrong, but I'm sure there are things that cats cannot imagine being another way. Like, for example, being alive. A cat to conceive of the possibility of not being alive. That's a guess. You know, I'd have to ask a cat, but well, I can't. So
maybe they have a flash of if they run across the road, they think, yeah.
Hang on, let me move this a bit further. And I understand the exceptions, but I really think that we sat down and we thrashed it out. You know, I would find, you know, the cracks in that story every which way.
Oh, to know it's right there. Okay. there we go.
the reason why I think something like the emergentist story is right, rather than the causal story being right, is because if the causal story was right, then there would not be the context dependency that we can observe in language and in knowledge generally. If there is a correspondence between our mental contents, our language, and the world, there would be some point that is fixed, that this is not changed as a consequence of context. But everywhere we look, context plays a huge role. And this is so well established. Therefore there must be something universal. The history of philosophy in this century is there's no universal. Right? We might think there is, we'd like to believe there is, but it's just not there. Wittgenstein and the shiftiness of meaning and all the whole language games thing and all of that. Quine, the indeterminacy of translation, the linguistics, I'm sure you're familiar with this. I see something, I go, Gavagai, or maybe I'm mispronouncing that, I never know how to pronounce that. And am I referring to a rabbit, or this particular stage in the life of a rabbit, or the physical instantiation of the spirit of the ancestor of the rabbit, or lunch? Could be any of these things, right? And we come up with these hypotheses, and we can say we share them, but it's a theory. From our individual point of view, it's always a theory. It's a best guess. We think maybe, but you know, it's always completely underdetermined by the evidence. Henson, the context dependency of causation. Henson uses the example: what caused the accident in the road? Was it the driver speeding? Was it the driver being drunk? Was it the failure of the brakes? Was it the shrub that prevented him from seeing the other car coming the other way? Was it the loose gravel on the road that caused the car to skid? From your point of view, whether you're a police officer, a road designer, a car manufacturer, that context matters. George Lakoff talking about differences in categories. There's no natural category. What you think of as a way of dividing the world depends, again, on your point of view. The woman firing dangerous things refers to one particular culture which divides the world into two things, or into two categories. In one category is woman firing dangerous things, and in the other category is everything else. Bastien van Frassen, doing his work on explanation. Why did the roses grow? And when you look at a question like that, the answer to that is always framed in the context of why not such and such. Why did the roses grow instead of dying? Why did the roses grow instead of pansies? Why did the roses grow instead of nothing? You know, for anything that you're asking a why question about, you're considering that why question against a range of alternatives. And that range of alternatives is based on the worldview that you're bringing to this. So, none of this works if we've got some kind of constant, universal, causal theory of meaning. Right? None of, you know, at some point, all of these would break down. Consequently, you know, it's this sort of thinking that leads me to sort of thinking about meaning and knowledge as pattern recognition. Because if all of this is true, the standard, here's the knowledge that P, we send the knowledge that P, and the person gets the knowledge that P, that story can't be true. Just can't be. So, how am I doing on time? I did see someone looking at a watch. How am I doing with you guys so far with this? I've lost a few, but I'll see how much time I have. Good. Okay. So, what is it to know, to learn, to teach, to understand in the network structure? It's not going to be based on some sort of causal story or some sort of correspondence story. The picture I've just given you, that's not going to happen. So the semantics, if we're going to start playing with semantics, say that things are true or false, known or not known, we need to look at networks themselves, the properties of networks themselves. And this part I can gloss over a bit, because it's not that controversial. Networks have basically three major elements. The entities, which might be, say, neurons or whatever, the connections between them, and then whatever signal is passed over those connections. And I'll point out the signal is just a signal. It's not corresponding to some entity or meaning or truth or falsity. It's just a signal. This gives us a way of talking about networks and the properties of networks, and I've drawn out a few things here, by no means all of them. The density, or that is to say the number of connections on average per entity, the speed with which something passes through the network, which can be measured in both time, or as they do in social networks, there is the number of hops it takes to go from one end of the network to the other. The flow, which may be a measure of the information, the number of signals that's going through the network at any given time, the plasticity, or how frequently the connections in the network change, the connectedness, which would be a function of the density of the network, the speed, the flow, the plasticity. In other words, how joined or non-joined the network is. And in this last one, you can actually imagine, if you will, a scale between completely non-connected, nothing connecting any of the members, and then completely connected. Every entity in the network is connected to every other entity in the network. And of course, there's a whole range in between, right? We've moved on. They've given up. I'm right. I knew that would get you. I'm just kidding, of course. This gives us a bit of a basis in which to begin talking about some of the terminology in networks. The context, for example, I talk about context a lot, and here now I will talk about the context of something being the localization of something inside a network. In other words, the context of an entity will be the set of other entities to which that original entity is connected, or possibly the set of other entities to which that entity is connected, or to which entities that it's connected to are also connected. The salience, this, and I really don't like bringing this out here, but I do want to bring this out here. By salience, when a pattern is presented in a network, this pattern may, if you will, resonate with existing patterns, or it might not resonate with existing patterns. In other words, it might be similar or dissimilar to previously existing patterns. Depending on that similarity or dissimilarity, the pattern that has been presented to you might stand out more or less. And if it stands out more, it's salient. In other words, salience is similar to recognition in the sense that it's dependent on similarities, dependent on something being presented to you being like something else that's being presented to you. But it's not exactly the same similarity. Again, that's something I need to spend a lot more time talking about. Emergence, we've talked about, is the development of patterns in the network, and then memory would be the persistence of these patterns in the network. And I'm really aware, I'll say this too, I'm well aware that this ground is choppy, that it doesn't move smoothly from one slide to the next, from one concept to the next. And so I'm giving you a landscape here rather than a story or rather than a logical argument. I'm just trying to highlight some of the different things that to me are important in this landscape. But where this landscape does lead us to eventually is something like connectivism. What I've done here is I've drawn out a few few of the theses that George Siemens has outlined in his paper called Natural Connectivism. And what Siemens is trying to say, and I think he has a point here, is that learning is the process of drawing these connections between ideas and indeed drawing these connections between people and between things in society. So, as he says there, a process of connecting specialized nodes or information sources. And then when you think of learning as being like this, as being this process of connecting, then you move away from the idea that learning is the accumulation of some sort of store of stuff in the mind, and rather learning is the pulling together of different ideas, the connecting with different things. So I would say, and I think he would say it less like than I would say, that learning is the acquisition of patterns of connectivity in the mind, which gives you the capacity to recognize that same pattern in new or novel circumstances.
He would probably say objects.
His point of view is more externally focused than mine. And George will say, for example, that knowledge is contained in society. The knowledge of the Paris is Paris is the capital of France. That's a social fact.
George agrees with me.
Well, George agrees with you to a certain degree. And my response is I would love to have that privileged access to what constitutes a social fact that you and George seem to have, because I'm just stuck in my little brain in my perceptions. And I don't have some sort of magical way of seeing all of society. But that's just me. And so learning and knowing and discovering and believing is basically a matter of nurturing and maintaining these connections. The example that I use that George really likes, it's just kind of ironic, but I like it too, the knowledge of how to fly 747 from London to New York. I didn't want to say Paris, but sometimes say Paris, but I don't want to.
How could you possibly agree on
this one? Yeah, that's what the flight recorders are for. You see, and that's just it, right? That knowledge isn't actually contained in any single person. The knowledge of how to fly that airplane is contained in a large number of people. And
the people who built the airplane, the people who are sending the information of the plane,
the person who built the navigation system, the one to Paris and one New York. And the thing is, this knowledge would not exist at all unless all of these individual people not only had whatever knowledge that they have, but unless they are connected together in relevant ways. If they're all just standing in a room, that isn't the relevant way to fly an airplane from New York to Paris or wherever. They need to not only be in whatever state that they are, have whatever knowledge that they have, they need to be connected in appropriate ways. The tire person needs to be employed by a tire company, for example. The navigation person actually has to have been hired by Boeing to put the navigation system into the airplane. All these connections need to be in place. And, when you think about it that way, too,
there has to be shared understanding of the concepts of what the final knowledge is going to be for.
Why?
Because otherwise you wouldn't get the airplane, you wouldn't get the Paris.
Sure, you can actually
do that. A different object. All of you would be together, the fireman would be going to shelter, but it wouldn't be...
If I do the fireman, I'd go to the plane and go to Paris, but...
When the fireman
goes to the plane, in your words, the relevant knowledge of things is building from the small to the big, and it's just...
It's the same thing that's happening here, right? You're assuming that because a person can access this bit of it, they can access the whole thing. And it's just
not.
The person manufacturing the tire, all they know is they're manufacturing it.
That's right.
And they might not even know that.
We might know that it's an airplane tire as opposed to a car tire.
They might not, but certainly
doesn't matter, but even the connection, how there has to be consensus in order to make those connections relevant.
It might not even be consensus. It might be slave labor. It might be an accident. Somebody might have found something that was created by somebody else.
The only problem I'm having here is that I can sort of say, okay, this is a red herring, it's not important, let's leave it alone. But until the next example we come up with basically is dependent on context, which also requires agreement. Before we all have the same context, there has to be an element of agreement. Right?
But as soon as you push this agreement again, it falls apart. I'm building a tire, say. And I'm building this tire, and say I even know that it's for a 747, right? And I build this tire, I build it full of intent and purpose, and I send the tire on, but over there they're manufacturing 767s, and my tire ends up on a 767. As it turns out, I was wrong. My tire isn't being used for the reason I thought it was being used. Is it now somehow inappropriate? Is it now, is this a 767, not now a 767? Right? The story has broken down. The shared agreement has broken down. In fact, I did not agree on the ultimate purpose.
I'm not saying that it's foolproof, but it's a basic
contract. Yeah. The agreement's not connections, it's not connected to the causation.
I never had any problem with causation. I only had consensus. See, the agreement
that you're bringing to the table here is like, it's like this agreement I see in classes, right? And the person walks up to the room like, okay, we're all going to study social studies today, right? We're all agreed on that? We're all agreed? Right. Okay, good. We're agreed on that.
But then define your terms as a group. What do we consider to be? That would be your next step in the classroom as well, is to decide, okay, what do we define
as a group? But think about what happens in the classroom. Is that really what happens in the classroom? Or does the teacher say it's going to be like this, and all the students say, yeah, okay, because the students want to pass?
Hopefully, in the modern university classroom, it's changed.
There would certainly be change from my experience then. In fact, it would be a miraculous 180-degree change from the entire history of education. I mean, this agreement that you're talking about, I argue, is a myth. I argue it's the presentation of the perception of one of the members of the conversation as the agreement. But it is not, in fact, an agreement.
How do you ever get this recording that? Because you guys agreed on the tools and the technology.
It's all my tools, it's all my technology. None of his stuff works.
It's called Skype. You can use Skype. Somebody designed Skype to allow for it.
Somebody designed Skype, but they certainly didn't have me in mind. And this is the thing. If you look at the history of the internet, you want to talk about unintended consequences. Right? Imagine that when they were building ARPANET, the U.S. military, that they thought that they were building the world's most effective foreign distribution system. Now, do you think there was some sort of shared understanding?
You can't have things fall apart.
But this isn't falling apart, though. I mean, nobody says that it's broken.
It can have multiple functions, but to have a context, you have to have a group of people who agree that that is their context. Otherwise, it's completely disparate.
That's right, it's completely disparate.
So are you saying this is all random and disparate? And
disparate doesn't mean random.
Okay, and random came with the lack of causality, and let's hear this. Okay.
All right. What we're seeing in practice, and what I'm trying to say here too is that, what counts as meaning, what counts as truth and knowledge is grounded, if you will, in the practice. And this is sort of what you're saying, but it's not what you're saying, okay? We looked at the practice, we looked at all of the things that are happening out there, and we each, as individual observers, try and see the patterns in that, to draw out from that what the likely theory of what's happening is. It's a real messy theory, because it means that nobody has the same theory, which means it can hardly be called a theory, and that's what I'm stuck with. So what is happening? What we're seeing is this very network phenomenon that I've been describing all along happening on a massive scale around the world right now. And that's what makes this kind of theorizing even possible. We couldn't even recognize this before, because this set of events has never happened. This is a set of events that's unique in human history. Now, what do we got? We got content offering and delivery happening all over the world. There's the blogging, the 86 million MySpace accounts, the podcasting, the broadcasting,
webcasting.
The webcasting. Is there webcasting? Oh, right, yeah.
Sorry, Dave.
We're seeing this content organized, we're seeing it sequenced, we're seeing it delivered. Here I'm thinking of things like RSS and other content syndication formats and content syndication networks that have formed out of that. We're seeing things like even basic things like identity and authorization and access and these things that define who we are and what we can do being defined and rolled out in this distributed manner. We looked at the utter failure of centralized authority-based identity systems like Microsoft Passport. And if we look at the future and even the present of identification systems now, we're seeing distributed identity systems where even a person's identity runs across a multitude of different locations. I'm reminded of even on this Dana Boyd's paper on MySpace and the use of MySpace and similar sorts of websites, blogging sites and others, as a means for people, especially young people, to create their own identity, to try on their own identity. So even a person's identity has become something that isn't just carried around in themselves, but it's distributed. My identity now is now across half a dozen websites or more. All
sometimes distributed in a way you don't actually like, because other people are contributed to your identity by creating parts of yourself which you don't necessarily agree with, but it becomes part of your distributed identity.
Absolutely. I mean, it's sort of like you become what people say you are, or something like that, in an odd, sort of weird networks kind of way. But it's true. There is no thing out there, or even in here, anymore that is my identity. It's one of the things that I've discovered now. I'm going to have to write about that, because, there's one of the things I discovered about myself on this recent trip is that I'm not the person I thought I was. Which was a bit of a surprise to me. but
considering how close you've been with yourself for all these years.
And not only that, studied myself. my primary object of inquiry, and after 47 years, I've gotten it wrong. I mean, how could that be?
Isn't that people who you visited thought you were something different than you?
And were more right about that than I was. Yeah. In some ways, in other ways, they're wrong too. But you know what I mean?
How much of that might be attributable to the fact that the experience of the trip changes who you are?
Well, that's certainly part of it too. When I did a video on Bogota not so long ago, so I went to Bogota and I was playing the video. At the end of my time in Bogota, when I first went to Bogota, I was in Colombia, right? World's most dangerous city, either that or Johannesburg, which I was 2 weeks later. Which is kind of weird because I lived an entirely safe life up until that point. But anyhow, at the end of my week in Bogota, I'm saying to Diego, I don't feel afraid anymore. I don't feel frightened of this city the way I was when I first got here. He says to me, well, Bogota hasn't changed. You haven't. And that's exactly right. So my identity changes on a day-to-day, even minute-by-minute basis, depending on what happens to me. So there's no thing really that is my identity. My identity now belongs in part to Vogelthal.
Well, I guess it's because identity doesn't necessarily have a concrete meaning in this case. I mean, is your identity your name? Is it your social insurance number? Is it, or is it more trying to capture who you are, which by nature is fluid and.
Yeah, but I mean, that's, if there's anything in this world I can be sure of, I mean, we were talking about Paris earlier.
How can you be so sure of a woman?
No,
say it's a dangerous city.
Well, and actually, no, it still is a dangerous city. This is the thing. It's just, I feel more safe.
That was yesterday, maybe it's not today.
Yeah, so it might have maybe a knowledge of
next slide.
Next slide, yes, I'm sorry.
All of these phenomena have together resulted in what people are calling these days Web 2.0. And Web 2.0 basically is the shift from the content-based web, if you will, to the interactive web. The shift from the web as media to the web as a platform. The place where you consume things to the place where you produce things. The place that is owned by other people to the place that is you. And you can see all the different changes there. And we've gone from, you know, the authoritative, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica created by the experts to Encyclopedia Wikipedia created by everybody, including the non-experts.
That's a really interesting one to bring up, because Wikipedia, the last time I looked through something on it, it said it's currently challenged. It's a population question.
Right.
And I was looking for the capital, which I can see through the capital, and their relative population.
Right.
And they said currently there is a challenge on this question, and therefore we can't, and yes, it's supposed to be multi-authored, so someone's perception is not acceptable within that realm.
Wikipedia has sort of narrowed its constraints recently. And I'm not sure necessarily in a positive direction, especially in the last 6 months or so, because of some of the criticisms. They've been putting more and more limitations on things and challenging
as Jimmy gets more and more famous. He wants to keep his famousness, I think, is what's going on.
Well, in part, too, there were some definite changes did need to be made due to defacing of entries and the purposeful publishing of hate content to certain individuals. Say there's a politician you know that's in a different camp than you, so you post some which may be true but are completely biased opinions.
It's actually really, really hard to do that.
It is now.
The one that snuck through that senator from, I forget where he was from.
He was
like an obscure government official that has come through the system. The system is not perfect for any other system.
Well, because, I mean, even now, I mean, Wikipedia is still early days, first of all, for Wikipedia. Secondly, there's still not the level of contribution that there could be and should be to an enterprise like that. And thirdly, but Senator Dixon fixed it and he said he's complained.
The biggest issue I have with Wikipedia is it portrays, it's a very minor thing, but the fact that it portrays what it's portraying as fact. And even if it were to say this is right on a bold heading top somewhere, which first like this is the considered opinion of a number of people. Because that's what bothers me. When I see people using Wikipedia as a reference, it always just makes me.
They should say that as well.
Well, you're right. I'm not
considered opinion. And most people like students think it's an encyclopedia. It's true.
Right. And then what it comes back to is the credibility with which you treat these things. You know, when you go to Encyclopedia Britannica, it carries with it a certain weight or the assumptions of a lot of people's mind that this has been fact-checked and verified and all the rest of it. Whereas, for me personally, at the moment, Wikipedia is the opposite. I assume that it's a bunch of raving lunatics typing things. Now, I think the reality is I'm wrong and it's somewhere closer to the the other, but there's a point on that, like, there's something about this that I find interesting. When we look at Wikipedia, the Encyclopedia Britannica, we accept as a given that any of the information in there might be updated.
Right.
We accept it as a given process, the fact that it's printed, that at least a year before whatever printing date we got, this was true according to someone. Now, the book we have is likely not going to be brand new. So we're accepting that the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years since this was printed, this was proper. So we make that adjustment when we read it. The thing that I ask people to do when they come to Wikipedia is there's a couple of adjustments that you have to make. You don't have to so much worry about the time thing.
Right.
Sue Netheim, who does a show in New York City, was a teacher there, called me out the day of the libel, the plane going into the building. The
9/11?
Yeah.
Oh, 10/11.
Yeah,
sorry.
He flew into the plane and flashed me.
Yeah, that's 10/11.
10/11?
Yeah.
And she messaged me and said, do you know what's going on? Because she's in the village on Manhattan Island, and she couldn't get any real information. I said, have you checked Wikipedia yet? And this was about 25 minutes after it happened. Well, the Wikipedia page was about 4 things long.
Yeah.
And it had all the relevant details, which all turned out to be accurate. There were, I think it was 25 posts a minute going on. And all of the links, all the stuff all around the world. So current-wise, you can't be better than Wikipedia. So you don't have to so much worry about that, but you do have to make certain allowances for the occasional senator stuff and the occasional other things. So to me, every time we approach a resource like this, we carry a little bit of, oh yes, and I know this is true, so I have to make sure of it. We're more accustomed to making the time adjustment. Because it's something we've had to do for years, but the adjustments we have to make with Wikipedia, I would say, are different, but no more or less.
Yeah.
I think what it comes down to is when it comes to something like an encyclopedia, we all have some understanding or belief in the sort of processes and checks and balances that are in place to try and ensure that the information in that is accurate. Whereas with Wikipedia, at the moment, I don't have the same kind of understanding as to exactly how that works. It so happens that a lot of the information that went into that particular account to turn out to be accurate, is that serendipity in this case, or is there something that's
out? I think it's kind of a retrograde situation, because what's happening is it's starting to be monitored in ways that say there's a challenge on this one. And it will, I think it's becoming more and more legitimate in the old-fashioned kind of way that we think of, or whether we should have thought of places in the media. But it's still monitored, and that's perhaps the individual offering.
And I'm thinking it's going to lose value the more it gets longer.
I think it gains value with it, unfortunately.
There is one that's being started called Cisenio. That is actually being run by experts so that it can be put the
Larry Sanger
is joining with the laptop project and put that together. I don't think it's as valuable. I think that you end up with far more biases that way, and you end up far further behind because it requires the person in charge of that particular area to make specific decisions.
Sure.
What I do like about Wikipedia is that many times you see articles that may contain biased information. And you are notified in a box that this article is thought to contain biased information. It's not necessarily true.
From the perspective of some middle income white guy in the United States, this article is biased.
Yes. But at least there is a warning there for people to realize, maybe if they see more of those kinds of notices, that they'll realize that, yes, there is checks and balances in place.
You see, I view the world in this twisted, weird way, right? I read something that everyone would accept as straightforward, true, and factual. I said, this is biased, because this is firmly rooted in our culture. There must be something wrong.
There's nothing that's not biased. It's impossible not to.
So, I mean, what's the point of saying this is biased, that's not biased? I mean, this is the sort of thing that management and oversight comes to. You get the more management and oversight you get, the more some bias becomes the received view. Mm-hmm. And everything else becomes bias.
Even what you choose to privilege over another, what you include, makes it a bias. So,
right.
Yeah.
And
my, and it's a few slides down, but what I say is that what brings, what keeps, I don't even want to say what keeps things true, but what leads us to accept things as true or factual or something like that is not a matter of, hey, a correspondence, it's not a matter of causation, it's not a matter of authority or anything like that, rather it's the process that put it together. And if, when you look at empirical observations, matters of fact, right? What did you see? Did you really see a unicorn? Did you really see a chair? It's the process of observation that grounds for us whether or not we really saw something. Right? Is it something I saw? Did another person see it? Did we all see it? Did I go see it again? All of these things that we just do habitually, right? It's not whether or not there's really a chair there. It's whether or not we follow the routine. Even with counting, we think about counting and numerical knowledge and all of this, right? Counting can go wrong. You don't really measure things, right? You measure things, measure it. But counting, if you're counting things, you've got to be sure that you're counting the same thing all the time. You go up there, you're counting sheep. Well, counting sheep's easy, right? How about counting good sheep? How about counting saleable sheep? How about counting animals in a field? Well, you count the insects too, right? I mean, as soon as you begin to push counting, counting begins to be a bit questionable. As soon as, even sheep. I mean, what counts as a sheep? Is a sheep, if it only has three legs, what counts as a sheep? If it's a wolf in sheep's clothing, does it count it? Would it be reasonable to count it, Again, it's the process of measurement, and I'm always drawn back to the militant oil drop experiments, and it's the process of doing this measurement that matters, not the measurements themselves. When you look at the way a scientist actually does measuring, they don't just take every bit of data that they got, they take the data that they consider to be good data, and they throw out the rest because that's bad data. Go check, or refire the blast post and so on. It's easier. Right. Sit down and we'll go through pretty much any empirical test, and I'll point out the assumptions in this that in one way or another change the way things are measured. When you count something, when you measure something, you bring an entire theoretical framework to bear. For example, even that this is something that we should measure. That these things that we are measuring exist. My last slide, and I'm going to skip ahead because I know I'm running out of time. Go to slide. Right. When you measure something, you are first assuming that the things you are measuring exist. You are secondly assuming that there are the sorts of things that can be measured. But what if they're not? Right? One of the things that we do in education is we measure achievement. We measure the knowledge that a person has, which means we measure the bits of knowledge that they have in their mind. But what if that doesn't exist? What if there is no set of entities that can be counted that are items of knowledge in their mind? How many tests have you done to evaluate e-learning where you're measuring the outcomes? Right. Are you really measuring knowledge? What if knowledge isn't even the sort of thing that you can measure? Right. This is what I'm getting at when I say, measurement is something, again, measurement, the sanctity of measurement, the believability of the results of measurement are things that are established not through some correspondence with reality, but through some adherence to a methodology or a process. And so too with networks. I'm going to skip back a bit here. Go to slide.
Oh, we're not going to see the mandatory image?
Oh, no, we're not.
Well, we could come back to that later, but I want to come. Overall, if we have a memory structure, it's going to have these various properties, and I've talked about these already, the decentralized, distributed, and so on. And among those is the second to last property, which I've called a network is democratic. And I sometimes call that the semantic element or the semantic property or the semantic condition, as I've done in this slide. And I meant to do that differently. But the process is diversity, autonomy, openness, and connectivity. In other words, networks that adhere to those four principles are more likely to produce knowledge that we believe is true, that we will trust, etc., than networks that do not correspond to those conditions. Networks that demand unity, that demand to be coordinated. This is why, like, you talk about shared understandings and all of this, right? This is why I hit this point of division with you. When we talk about shared understandings, what you're trying to do is you're trying to say, the people in this room or the people in this collection all have the same property, and that's what grounds our knowledge, right? But what I'm saying is, when you try to interpret it that way, when you're trying to say, or even make them all be the same, what that is in fact doing, if you view this from a network perspective, is making that group less reliable and not more reliable. The minute you start saying, well, let's get a common understanding, let's ground our terms, right? What you're doing is you're eliminating the diversity that the members bring to the table. And it's this diversity that creates the capacity for knowledge in a network. And so, and similarly with autonomy, the counter condition being coordination, right? And networks can reliably reflect, if you will, the states of affairs in the world, if you will, I'm glossing that a bit there, if each entity in the network functions independently. But if, by contrast, if they all do, if you have a network where you have one entity makes the decisions and every other entity does what the first one did, then the reliability of that network is based on the reliability of one entity in that network rather than the entire network. It's the old story, right? No matter how good a dictator is, a dictator cannot run a country. No dictator is smart enough to run a country. Because no single person is smart enough to run a country, just like no single person can go to 747 for the same reasons. Which is why there has to be autonomy in a network. Each entity in the network has to make its own decisions. And again, this runs against the sharing, right? The autonomy is each person for themselves deciding what a word means. And then they can interact, rather than trying to create this sort of pseudo space in the middle where there is some sort of authentic knowledge, whatever that may be.
Do you have some examples of these networks? Or are you saying that, creating a 747 is an example?
Well, that is a pretty good example.
Well,
the running of a country, the building of a city, who can design a city? Well, you can design cities. I've seen one, Milton Keynes. I've never lived there. Never in a million years lived there.
Some cities are well laid out, and others are complete monstrosity. City planning, whatever. But I'm thinking specifically of a group of people who. To get most out of the group if they don't share the goal. Can you not have both the diversity and benefit from that diversity while at the same time bring that diversity to a shared goal?
Now, there are cases where shared goals work, like team sports, for example, is a good example of that. I think that a lot of the cases where that we depict as being instances of shared goals are not in fact that. You look at
to me, these are teams that form in the university environment or a company environment or something like that. And they all get in the room, and the manager says, okay, here's the shared goal for this committee. And I'll bet you $1 to donuts. We've got 9 people in that room, we've got 9 agendas. Right? Those sometimes still work. And my contention is that they work better if
the manager's not there.
Well, for ours and me, that's true, right? The minute you start pushing somebody off their own agenda, that's where you get the basis for mistrust.
Okay, I've got an analogy that I would draw that sort of goes back to the 70s. I can remember being back in the 70s and being at a community college and people saying, okay, we're going to rely on the floor to have class today. And I can remember one particular case, I wanted to sit in the chair, and did. And they were saying, like, what's wrong with you? Why do you have to sit in a chair? Unfortunately, that's the way, there's sort of an evolution that happens. The establishment, no matter how radical and diverse it might be, has a tendency to become...
Sure.
Yeah.
You cannot change society by changing the government. Have to change the people.
I mean, the diversity element is great, and I tend to think it's not vain, but at the same time, I think that most people, unfortunately, in this world, think that we can't function without a structure, and that a structure will impose itself on anything that is wrong with the law. And I don't know if it will or not.
Yeah, and my suggestion is that even whether it does or whether it doesn't, right? It's better if it doesn't.
Just better.
Yes.
Then you have to go to something else. Rather than as soon as you hit the stage where this becomes the establishment, you have to move on and find a new open version of what you've now created. Because as soon as there's lots of lessons built into these things. Because then you're the norm and you have to then go to something else, right?
No, not necessarily. If you have built in the diversity and the autonomy, then you've built in a constraint that prevents some noise from coming in and occupying your network.
I don't know. Look at countries like Sweden.
We've got to finish the company.
Yeah, we've got to finish.
Everybody is sort of long
past.
Yeah, we have to finish.
A couple of meetings and
I'm saying, all of you have been really patient, and if anyone is online, you've been really, really patient.
They've been making stuff a little bit.
The take home from all of this is, if something like this is true, then it tells us that a centralized, directed, ordered form of learning is not the way to go, and that the way to approach learning online is to use a distributed mechanism, and that means that your technology as well is going to be distributed. Instances of it will interact with each other in the form of a network, and it means that in order to maximize the student outcomes, student learning, then in this network you would encourage diversity and autonomy and openness and connectedness, which is, in other words, student-directed or student-initiated learning. And that's the very short version of the longer statement of that.
Student-directed learning.
Pardon?
Oh, that's great.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to give a... I think that's great, student-directed learning, but who decides what the direction is going to be?
Student. That's why it's student-directed learning. I know they won't do what you want them to, but that's the whole point.
I won't do anything. In particular, what I'm saying is, you just kind of put a bubble up there and say, here, go. Are you going to get somebody who is able to do brain surgery on that? Maybe not. There's got to be some kind of a direction or a culture in which to direct that learning so like people of like interests can draw.
should be more like a kidnapping than a guided tour.
Okay.
Well, but what you've described, as soon as you start composing, then it's more like a kidnapping. Just because I say it's student directed doesn't mean we don't give them any information. That would be stupid. Right? But it means that the decision what to study, what not to study, and indeed whether or not to become a brain surgeon at all ever is up to the students. Right?
How do you get in an open, diverse, connected environment for student learning? How?
What do they sign up for?
Thank you. What do they sign up for? Or maybe not sign up. What I'm trying to say is, if there's no commonality of interest in a student-directed learning environment, then there's no concentration of knowledge.
Can I ask you one question?
Yes.
How do you learn how to use eSpace?
Through listserv and trial and error.
And you went out and sort of found the information?
I found the like-minded people who had the same interest.
Did you want to be organized up there and ask for you, or did you just go to find them?
Okay.
It is organized.
Somebody.
Somebody initializes the listserv, somebody manages the listserv.
Did someone tell you to go to the listserv?
No. My father
is directed?
Yes, somebody directed. Yes. Okay, but it's still like-minded people.
And I think that's the goal.
It might not even be like-minded people.
You may not even be using it for the same reason.
But there's going to be that bit of information in the middle that is interesting about all the people that are involved in that particular environment.
I think from my point of view, your goal was to learn to use eSpace. Right? Now, that goal was directed by someone. So somehow you came to the conclusion, or maybe you discovered yourself, this was a good tool. And so once the students have a goal of some kind, I need to become familiar with this, then I can see this all apply. I'm just having a little bit of a problem getting my head around the bootstrap. Like, how do students who want to learn a particular thing come together?
These things happened, and then they unhappened. various reasons, and possibly because suddenly people started taking the meds and getting degrees with sort of ersatz, sort of not, you know, but for whatever reason, we went towards the system, and the pendulum swings back, and we'll go towards it again, and the pendulum will swing back. You've got to, it's always changing. It's a dynamic thing, and there's not an ideal on one either end of the spectrum. It's trying to be inclusive of both the whole, all elements, right?
See, I would disagree even that an independent studies program at a university is anything like learner directed learning. Because, you know, independence in a university is kind of like freedom and time.
Well, that's right, but guess what? Surprise. Just about everybody is co-opted in one way or another. We are part of this society, you know?
You
know, even anybody who has a PhD, I used to have a PhD who thought he was a postmodern and passive entropy on his rear end. He's got a PhD. He had to study day and night to get it. He was part of the establishment, and so he could pretend to have streaky hair all he wanted and be a free thinker. But he was about as non-free thinker. If you can get a PhD, you've got to toe the line. I don't care who you are.
Which tells us something about PhDs, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
But it doesn't tell us something about.
But I think your idea is that the academy is sort of this whole old-fashioned banking system of knowledge, and we didn't have this whole, I mean, student-centered learning has been a movement for years and years, right? And now we're trying to integrate it with e-learning, and that's great, but, you know, there'll be variations, and one isn't bad, one isn't good, it's picking good things from each one, right?
Which you said.
So now that I've
well, thank you for your disagreement.
Actually, that makes for really great audio.
Oh, I know it does. As long as it's all there. That's fine. I mean, like, I am going to disagree. We are going to disagree.
You mean, how can you still disagree?
I'm to the point, I've gone through point by point here. And I can't imagine that you're still clinging to this idea of universal truth and authority.
I don't believe there's a universal truth. But I wouldn't call anything.
If you don't have universal truth, then how do you justify the imposition of authority to enforce it?
I don't think there's
a
universal truth. Right? I was into consensus. Was that the same thing? You made it authority. You said there's no such thing as consensus. It's one guy, manager, who's directing it. If your system is utopian, mine could be utopian and say consensus, real democracy can work, right? Where people are inputting equally.
I would consider it a miracle, given that you and I don't even have the same thoughts, how we could have agreement on the topic.
But we're going to do something pretty identically for two people who are diametrically opposed. I'm going to go up now, you're going to go up, I'm going to get in the car, you're going to get a car.
I don't drive.
Okay, you're going to get in your Jetson job, or Jetson thing, and go wherever. Okay.
Thank you.
This has been very provocative.
And on that note, I think we're done. So thanks a lot. I really appreciate you guys coming out and even more of the point sticking with it. It's good. It's
I mean, I started talking about this everywhere.
Yeah, well, I'm just not done thinking about it. That's all.
Yeah, that is perfectly.
Yeah, I like that.
Come to see MPC.
There's a spectrum of colors.
Yeah, there's a lock on the outside of the door. That's locked in.
That's
the
door.
Okay.
Well, let's see if there's anybody with us on the Skype cast.